From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Tom Santapietro returns to the show this week, and it's always a pleasure to have him back. He's written a lot of great books about some of my favorite performers and films, including The Sound of Music, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Way We Were, The Godfather, Barbara Streisand, Doris Day, Frank Sinatra. Tom Santapietro is also a performer, a lecturer, interviewer, and a Broadway stage manager. His latest book is Audrey Hepburn, A Life of Beautiful Uncertainty. Tom Santapietro, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thanks very much for having me back on.
Yeah, so, Tom, it feels like this book is maybe more personal than your previous books. I mean, I always enjoy the journey with you, but this one feels like it's more invested. Am I wrong?
You are 100% correct, and I've started to realize that when a number of people have said that to me. So obviously, it's there in the book. And I think the reason for that is because Audrey Hepburn was such an extraordinary person. And on some level, I think it's personal because the world is so upside down right now that I wanted to celebrate somebody who was not only talented, but a force for good in the world.
And she certainly was that. But why is it called Beautiful Uncertainty? What do you mean by that?
That was a very deliberate subtitle because Audrey Hepburn herself, of course, was such a beautiful woman and a beautiful soul. But she never, ever believed that she was. She did not think she was attractive. She did not think she was a good actress. At one point in her life, she said, "I don't understand why anybody would want to marry me." And I thought, oh, that's so interesting psychologically, because she was uncertain of herself her whole life.
I wanted to marry her.
Many, many millions did as well.
right, as soon as I saw her. Are you like a fashion expert before this? Because there's a lot of, you really seem to understand fashion. I mean, did you have to study up for Audrey Hepburn, A Life of Beautiful Uncertainty?
I definitely had to study up.
No.
It was a very fast crash course in high fashion. And then, so I learned, you know, that's a part of the process. And then a very good friend of mine, Jeffrey Banks, who's a terrific, well-known fashion designer, said he would help me out. He wrote the captions for the really high fashion pictures because his knowledge is extraordinary. And he knew Audrey. So it was a, sort of a great combination.
This book, it's a very beautiful book. I just love it. It's almost a coffee table book, but not quite. I mean, it's bigger than the average book, but it's not coffee table size. But it has so many beautiful photographs. And I was talking with a biographer, Eve Golden, recently, and she told me that every photograph that she includes in any of her biographies, she has to pay for herself. Was that the case with you?
I will certainly pay for many of them. Uh-huh. they gave me a photo budget, but I freely admit I overshot the budget because Audrey's appeal was so visual that I really wanted this to be an important part of the book. I have 70 photos in the book, which is a lot.
Yeah, and they're beautiful, and they're reproduced so beautifully. They're not, you know, it's not, it's just like a little newsprint photo section. It's like some beautiful, beautiful pictures in there.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
I also see a lot of connections to your favorites and mine in this book, that is, there's overlapping with some of your other, let me give you for instance. So Audrey Hepburn and Barbara Streisand, who's the subject of two of your previous books, they both won Oscars for their first films, and both of those films were directed by William Wyler.
Nice connecting of the dots there. That's great.
And the year that Audrey Hepburn won for Roman Holiday was the year that Frank Sinatra, subject of your great Frank Sinatra in Hollywood book, won his Oscar for From Here to Eternity, same year, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's definitely connections amongst all of these books.
Yeah, all of your characters. Doris Day shows up for a minute. And...
Yeah. I feel, and you know, I've realized twice now, I've realized underlying reasons why I wrote books only after the books are completed. And when I completed the Audrey Hepburn book, I thought, oh, I've now completed a trilogy of books about these enormous female stars who were such good people that, unlike most of Hollywood, they were beloved by the people they worked with. That was Audrey Hepburn, Doris Day, and Julie Andrews. Mm. And at the same time, I had realized only after completing my book on To Kill a Mockingbird, I thought, oh, I've written a trilogy of books about family and the different ideas of family. And those were The Godfather, Sound of Music, and To Kill a Mockingbird, yeah. All about families.
Yeah. Well, you have your interests, and they're good, and they happen to be my interests as well, which is perfect. I wanted to ask you about Audrey Hepburn's the research you did into Audrey Hepburn's life and the people you talked to. Patricia Bosworth was a friend of mine here on From the Bookshelf, and she passed away in the early days of COVID. I was so upset because I didn't get a chance to say goodbye. Did you talk to her?
I was unable to because of when she passed away.
Yeah.
However, her book, which was so terrific and talked about the making of Nun's Story, which she was in with Audrey.
Right.
And also, it turns out that two of my very good friends lived in the same building as Patricia Bosworth.
Ah.
So I was able to cull information from them as well. And her account of what Audrey was like was not only immediate and beautifully written, but really gave me a sense of Audrey's interior life. So it was enormously helpful.
She was a terrific person, and all of her books are worth reading. And I'm sorry she's gone. But who did you talk to?
Well, I had the biggest help was I had several very lengthy interviews with Audrey's son, Sean Hepburn Ferrer.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean was terrific and very forthcoming. And because those interviews went well, Sean arranged for me to speak to his daughter, Emma, oh. Audrey's granddaughter. So that was very helpful. I talked to film historians, people who worked at UNICEF, which was such an important part of Audrey's life. And then, although most of Audrey's co-stars and directors are no longer with us, I had one of Alan Arkin's last interviews and also a very nice talk with Robert Wagner, both of whom had starred in films with her. So those were very helpful.
Robert Wagner's great. He's been on the show here before as well.
It's such a gentleman. And Alan Arkin was terrific and was sort of hilarious because when I finally, you know, after the interview was arranged and got him on the phone, the first sentence out of his mouth was, "Well, I hear you've been looking for me." Oh, yes, I have.
Of course, Alan Arkin co-starred with Audrey Hepburn in Wait Until Dark, which was kind of... I mean, she made more movies after Wait Until Dark, but that's kind of like her last film of her first career in films.
It absolutely, because after Wait Until Dark, she didn't make another movie for 9 years, which is 50 years in any other industry. And I love Wait Until Dark, and the novelist Stephen King, and I include this quotation in the book, said, "It's the scariest movie ever made."
It's a very scary movie, and I remember when it played in theaters, they had a deal where toward the very last moments of the movie, they turned out all the lights, even the exit lights in the theater, so the theater was totally dark, and people screamed.
and you still do. When I rewatched it for the book, and I sort of tried to recreate that, and I turned off all the lights in my apartment and shut the drapes. And at that moment near the end, I still jumped.
Yeah, it's scary. and her acting is really good in that movie. I mean, she's a good actress in all of her films, but you know, she was in that particular role. Not only does she play a blind woman, but she, you know, has to emote in ways that she had never emoted in a film before.
Absolutely. It's a terrific performance. And she really studied hard. She went to the School for the Blind, Lighthouse School here in New York City. And she took her work seriously. It's a great performance.
Now, I know you're a, a, a big Fred Astaire fan, and you've done an audio commentary on a Fred Astaire Blu-ray or two. And I want to ask you about this. I don't know how you do that, but anyway, those are great. I watched Funny Face the other night because I was reading your book, and I had seen it before, but I completely forgot how amazing Funny Face is. That movie is a startlingly wonderful visual feast. And when Audrey sings her first song in the film, it is so touching. I mean, she can really sing.
Yeah, it's a great film. I'm so glad you like it, because all these years later, and, you know, it's been nearly 70 years, the movie really holds up. And she and Astaire are terrific together. And, you know, that was a joyous experience for Audrey, because she had grown up wanting to be a dancer. And when she was approached about Funny Face, she said, "I'll do the movie if Fred Astaire is my co-star." So she had a fantastic time.
And Kay Thompson, Think Pink, that's one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
Yes.
The VistaVision, that was an interesting... you talk in the book a little bit about how the CinemaScope lens was difficult for Audrey, but VistaVision, that was just a bigger piece of film. It wasn't a different lens, I guess.
Right. And so the VistaVision wasn't a problem. The CinemaScope, when she was making, unfortunately, one of her worst movies called Green Mansions, it was a real problem. She was very unhappy with the early rushes, and then they were able to adjust the lenses, and she was much happier. And ironically, Green Mansions was made as a trade-off for having her do Funny Face. It was all about contracts at different studios.
Well, Funny Face is definitely the better movie.
That's a pretty safe statement.
It's better than almost anyone. Well, let's talk about, you know, I think her worst movie is the movie that people love the most and think of her all the time in, which is Breakfast at Tiffany's. I just think Breakfast at Tiffany's, she's great, but it's a terrible movie.
Well, I would partially agree with you. How's that?
Okay.
Audrey is great in Breakfast at Tiffany's, and there's a reason why it's so well remembered, because you instantly think of the opening of the film, that extraordinary sequence in the silent dawn of New York City in front of Tiffany's, and then, of course, her singing of Moon River.
So charming.
And you know, the movie is very uneven because, well, first of all, it's so terrible when Mickey Rooney is playing an Asian American. It's embarrassing.
It's awful. It definitely ruins the movie.
That is very difficult. If you could snip his scenes out, it would definitely be better. And I think the other thing is maybe what you're reacting to is, you know, it was made very early in the 60s, and Hollywood was still very skittish about the fact that Audrey's character was, you know, a call girl. So they had to be so careful and tread the dividing line with the screenplay, and that makes it uneven. But when she's on the screen looking the way she does, I think, along with millions of others, forgive everything. I think you didn't forgive everything.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting because, yes, she's supposed to be a prostitute, but they never say it. I mean, she's not really a prostitute in the film, but she is in the book. And it's interesting to compare it to two other movies, both of which won Best Picture. One of them is Gigi, mm-hmm. and the other is Anora.
Yeah. Right?
Two movies about prostitutes that don't hide the fact that they are prostitutes.
Right.
I mean, Gigi, it's amazing that they got away with making Gigi at all.
And, I think Gigi, you know, and of course it's interesting because Audrey starred in Gigi on Broadway. It was the first thing that put her on the map.
Right.
But they get away with Gigi because of the way the movie looks and because those Lerner and Lowe songs are very distracting, and you forget the fact, oh, they're grooming her as a courtesan.
Yeah.
And so whereas, you know, Breakfast at Tiffany's, aside from Moon River, there are no musical numbers.
No, that's too bad.
The viewer.
She sang that song so beautifully, and she sings. I mean, that's the thing in Funny Face when she sings, "How long has this been going on?" At first, she's sort of tentative in her voice. She's kind of talking it, but by the end of the song, it's a full-throated singing.
Yeah,
and I have seen the outtakes of her singing in My Fair Lady, 1964, and she sang fine. I don't understand what happened in My Fair Lady.
Well, I think the chapter I wrote on My Fair Lady is the longest chapter in the book because I just thought the backstory was so fascinating. And to speak to your point, Audrey had trained to sing the score. She thought all along she was going to sing the score, and they only told her quite far into the filming that she was going to be dubbed. And if you look at the, just as you did, the scenes you can see where she's singing, as in Wouldn't It Be Loverly, she's fine. The only thing that would have needed to be dubbed is sort of the end of I Could Have Danced All Night with the high notes and you have to belt it to kind of spin the story forward. And aside from that, she could have sung it. It's a loss that she didn't. And one of the points I make in the book is that it became so controversial and she wasn't nominated for an Oscar when she should have been. And yet you go forward 50 years and Rami Malek lip syncs to Freddie Mercury and wins the Oscar, even though he didn't sing a note. Times change.
Yeah, right. As Anora versus Breakfast at Tiffany's demonstrates.
Yes, right.
Anora, by the way, I don't think is a good movie, but just pointing out the fact that they don't disguise any part of her profession in the movie.
Right. I think there are many reasons why Anora swept the Oscars the way it did.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I consider it a film for the ages. We'll
put it what do you think were the reasons? People have asked me, you know, they say, Gary, you know a lot about movies. What did I miss in Anora? And I said, I don't know. I missed it too.
I think people tapped into the kind of plucky underdog story of how the film was made. And that is his name, Sean Baker.
That's right.
That Sean, you know, wore all those hats so successfully on the film. And I think also, you know, the Oscars, there's so many reasons why things win. There was no other film that people really felt passionate about. And I just think there was enough voters who thought, well, oh yeah, that's an underdog film and look what they did. Okay, I'll vote for that. And then it wins Best Picture.
Yeah.
Which surprised me.
I would have been surprised, but the New York Times told me 3 days earlier that it was going to win. And then I was very surprised. I said, what? It's actually when I was watching the film, I was watching it with my wife and halfway through, I sort of panicked and I thought, oh, I'm showing her the wrong movie. There must be another Anora that is nominated for all those Oscars. It can't be this one. But it was. So back to Audrey Hepburn.
And you're still married?
Yeah, that's right. back to Audrey Hepburn. You said you talked to her son. What does her son do? What was his life like?
Well, Sean, as a young man, he was involved in the film industry and carved out a successful career on the production side. He had one acting job, which is in the Peter Bogdanovich film with Audrey. They All Laughed.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a nice presence on screen, but he had no passion for acting. And then after he had worked for quite a while on the production side, after his mother died, he really took over managing her legacy. It's a full-time job because her image is everywhere. And he became very involved with her charitable work. And, you know, the Audrey Hepburn Children's Fund at UNICEF. And he has then passed that on to his daughter, Emma, with whom I also spoke. So there is a real family legacy of giving back.
Well, Tom Santopietro, in your book, Audrey Hepburn, A Life of Beautiful Uncertainty, You're pretty unequivocal that The Nun's Story is her greatest film, her greatest performance. You want to talk a little bit about that film?
Yeah, I do think it is definitely her greatest performance. I was so startled when I looked at it again because, you know, everybody thinks of Audrey Hepburn as so beautiful, rightfully, but always wearing Givenchy and swanning around on screen. And this entire performance, she's enveloped in a full nun's habit. There is no high fashion in sight. And so the performance is given with her eyes, you know, and her intelligence is so palpable. And the movie is grappling with issues that we all grapple with, which is, you know, issues of faith. And are there higher powers? And where do our loyalties lie? And, you know, it's all based on a real life person. And by the end of the film, you've been taken on such a journey. And of course, she had Fred Zinnemann directing, who's a fantastic director. So I absolutely think it's her best performance. And I was talking to the great film historian Janine Basinger about the performance. And she said to me, Tom, not only should she have won the Oscar that year, but it's one of the greatest performances in a major Hollywood film ever. And she doesn't say things like that lightly.
She's great. I love Janine. She's been on the show also a few times.
Absolutely. And she also said something hilarious when we were talking about it, so people don't think it's all too serious,
yeah.
Which is she said, I love Audrey Hepburn in The Nun's Story. And she said, I don't say that lightly because I do believe I was frightened as a child when I saw The Song of Bernadette.
I never watched a lot of movies about nuns because I don't know, I'm not interested in it. I mean, I kind of turned off to all those religious themed movies that Jewish filmmakers felt, you know, they must make King of Kings and The Greatest Story Ever Told. And
right. Ben yeah. But I think I personally think The Nun's Story is in a class by itself. I really think it's such a well-made film, and you know, she prepared so well for it, and that's where she was co-starring with Patricia Bosworth, and they became such good friends.
Yes, it wasn't until I met Patricia Bosworth on From the Bookshelf that I finally watched The Nun's Story, and it's great, and Patricia Bosworth is quite good in it, but she felt her career couldn't go anywhere from there.
Right. Yeah, it's funny how these careers...
And became a great writer instead.
Yeah.
Very interesting. What do you think of one of my favorites is How to Steal a Million? I think that is a delightful picture.
She made How to Steal a Million because she really wanted to make another film with William Wyler, and who had directed her in Roman Holiday and The Children's Hour. And I think the film is entertaining. I think it works in fits and starts. And there are some set pieces that go on a little long. But, you know, if you're watching a movie and you have Audrey Hepburn and Peter O'Toole, how can you go wrong? They're both so charming.
And,
so,
you know, it's odd to see her with an age-appropriate romance. I mean, most of them, I want to talk about that. Most of the men that she was with in her earlier films, I mean, Gregory Peck doesn't seem that much older, but Fred Astaire and Cary Grant and a lot of those actors, Gary Cooper, are a lot older.
Yes, Humphrey Bogart and Sabrina.
Bogart, yeah.
Yeah, that, and that's something I wanted to look at in the book because... First of all, it's very interesting that that was a motif that recurred over and over. It probably wouldn't happen today. Our views are very different on things like that. But also, it was really a manifestation of Audrey's personal life because she was always looking for a father figure. Her first fiancé, whom she didn't marry, James Hansen, was much older. Mel Ferrer was her first husband, was 13 years older. And that all stems from the fact that Audrey's father walked out on the family when she was 6 years old. It was as if he disappeared and went to buy a pack of cigarettes and never came back. And she felt that lack her whole life to the point where she said nothing in her life was as difficult to deal with, including her miscarriages. The loss of her father overshadowed everything.
Hmm. And what did she ever connect with him later?
Oh, it's sad. They were really not in contact. He didn't make an effort. He was a fascist and spent World War II in jail in England for his views and support of Oswald Mosley, you know, the leader of the British Union of Fascists. And there would be the occasional letter, but he was so closed off, he made no effort. And so, but she supported him financially when she became famous. And I include the scene in the book at the end of his life, when she received news that he was dying. She and her then companion, Robert Walters, went to visit her father. And she went in to talk to her father. He's dying. And he was so closed off, he couldn't speak to her about anything personal. He was talking to her about his horses. Mm. And that saddened her, of course, unbelievably so. And she came out of the room, and Robert Walters went in to talk to her father. And everything he couldn't say to Audrey, he said to Robert Walters. He said to Robert Walters how proud he was of his daughter, how proud he was of everything she had accomplished. So there was a peace in that, but it's a very sad, fragmented relationship.
Yeah. Interesting. There's a lot of interesting things in your book, Audrey Hepburn, A Life of Beautiful Uncertainty, Tom Sanchipietro. So back to this older men in films thing. You know, I know it was totally acceptable. Then there's a lot of things we see in films, like Mickey Rooney in Yellowface, that nobody thought anything about in the time that the movie was released. And now those things don't age as well, and they seem creepy. And particularly in Funny Face, when Fred Astaire first kisses her in this bookstore, you know, he looks a lot older than her. It's a kind of a strange moment in the movie. And again, they would never do it now. But then, you know, nobody seemed to think anything of it. And I know that Astaire, when he was working with Leslie Caron, he finally said, no, I'm not going to kiss her because she's 12 and I'm 75.
Right.
But that was his decision, not the studios. The studios would have been happy to have him kiss her.
Right. Yeah. It's just very, very different mores back then, and things that didn't get a second glance that today we would never, ever approve of. So, but to me, the interesting part is, as I said, that I feel all of that stems from her own psychology. It's what she was comfortable with because she lacked that father figure. And, you know, she had a very, sort of related to that, a very close but difficult relationship with her mother, with whom she was intertwined in many ways. And I'm branching off a little here, but one of the extraordinary things I wanted to bring up in the book is that when Audrey made it so big at the beginning with Roman Holiday, with that older man motif, and wins the Oscar, and within 2 months of that wins the Tony Award for Best Actress as Ondine. And her mother, this very formidable aristocratic woman, Baroness von Heemstra, said to her daughter, Audrey, you know, it's amazing what you've accomplished considering how little talent you have.
What a nice, nice thing. Mothers.
That psychology interested me because it does all go back to childhood. And I draw the parallel with one of my other subjects, is the reason why Barbara Streisand has such long fingernails is because her mother said to her, you should be a typist. So she grew her fingernails so she couldn't type.
Speaking of that, I wanted to ask you, since we last talked, Barbara Streisand has published a mammoth autobiography. I'm sure you've read it, or maybe you're still reading it. And I wonder what your thoughts were.
I thought, of course, I read the book. First, I made a joke about it, which was it's 990 pages and it brings her to age 10.
Right.
but of course, I read it. I think the book is actually very good. I think it's completely honest. I think she doesn't pull punches. And that I found fascinating because she, and it, for those who have read it or will read it, Barbara Streisand forgets nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing at all. She remembers what she wore 50 years ago. You know, she is a very smart woman. And when I had an email exchange with her, which was fascinating for my book on The Way We Were, every question I asked would come back with one, two long paragraphs with total recall of details from a film that was made 50 years ago.
So, well, she goes into it in quite a lot of detail in her book. And I wonder, did you learn anything that you hadn't known when you wrote your book?
Honestly, Gary, not very much. You know, she had answered my questions in detail. And I, because I was able to talk to other people involved with The Way We Were, you know, I do know that film inside out, yeah, as I know Audrey's films inside out, you yeah know, and that's the joy, is doing that kind of research. So I've lost track of how many times I've seen, you know, My Fair Lady, because it's just, I love watching her in it.
So great. And she's great in it. It's wonderful. And yeah, it really doesn't matter that she's dubbed, but still, it would have been lovely if it hadn't been.
Well, I yes, and I think the film would have been better for it. But one thing that I talk about in the book that I think is important is that in all that controversy of Audrey instead of Julie Andrews, what people forget, if you look at My Fair Lady again, you know, almost half the story is after she becomes a lady. It doesn't happen at the end of the movie. And she's trying to figure out her place. She's too elegant now for the flower market, but she doesn't really belong in the aristocracy. And my point is that I make in the book, the key line is when she, as Eliza, says, "What's to become of me?" So not only is this universal, because we're all trying to figure out our place in life, but when I spoke to her son, Sean, Sean said, "That's my mother." That she was so vulnerable. And after her father walked out, trying to figure out where she belonged. And that's why having her own family and children was so important. And I think that part of the film is richer for Audrey being in it, because Julie Andrews, wonderful as Julie Andrews in, you know, Julie Andrews can take care of situations. She's going to, you know, roll up her sleeves, clap her hands, and that's why she's great as a nanny in Mary Poppins and The Sound of Music. Right. But Audrey is so vulnerable that it deepens the film. And I reread the New York Times review when the film first came out, and it was a very positive review. And the Bosley Crowther, the critic, said, that scene that I'm talking about, he called it almost painful to watch. It's so raw.
Well, Julie Andrews had a television special sometime in the, I don't know, late 60s or 70s. And on the special, she was dancing and singing with other versions of herself, one as Mary Poppins and one as Eliza Doolittle. And she said to Eliza Doolittle, "Oh, you're my favorite." And Eliza Doolittle says, "Why didn't you play me in the movie?" And Julie Andrews said, "They made a movie."
Of course, Julie, somebody else who doesn't forget.
Yeah, Julie Andrews did win the Oscar the year that My Fair Lady came out.
Right. Yeah.
Do you think that Julie Andrews, you're not saying that she's not the actress that Audrey Hepburn is, or are you?
I think their affect is so completely different from each other. Julie Andrews would have been great in the movie of My Fair Lady. I'm just talking about this aspect of it, that vulnerability. Audrey Hepburn was definitely more vulnerable than Julie Andrews. Julie, there's a little bit of steel in her spine, which has helped her in her career. Audrey was a very vulnerable person. And I think that's what led her to her incredible work for UNICEF, because she felt that need so much.
How did Audrey Hepburn feel about Mickey Rooney's performance in Breakfast at Tiffany's? Did she ever express anything about that?
She never did in all my research. But that's because at the time, nobody was commenting on it. It was only in later years that I read interviews with Blake Edwards, the director, Julie Andrews' husband.
Right.
And he talked about, that's tough to look at today. Audrey was so conscious of how other people's feelings that she just would never have said anything that she thought might hurt Mickey Rooney's feelings. It's just mind-boggling. So there you go.
Well, I was talking with George Chakiris here on the show not too long ago, and mm-hmm. he won the Oscar for playing Bernardo in West Side Story, and well-deserved. He's fantastic. And I said, well, of course, they would never cast you now in that role. And how do you feel about that? And he said, well, I think that's fine. I think, it's good that they, that they cast people of color in roles of people of color. Mm-hmm. But he said, of course, you'd also would not have Anthony Quinn in Zorba the Greek or Alec Guinness in Lawrence of Arabia. And he named a few interesting parts like that. Audrey Hepburn plays a blind woman and she's not blind. Should all blind parts be played by blind people?
Right. This is a, ongoing debate in all art forms now, and there are no clear-cut answers to it, I think. But we can't cut off means of artistic expression, I think, to fit into pigeonholes. And Audrey Hepburn was a terrific actress and should have played a blind woman in Wait Until Dark. And also the film was a hit and made millions of people more aware of the predicament that blind people face. So, things are not always black and white.
Speaking of that, I had a student who complained that I was talking about blackface in the cinema in my film appreciation class. Mm-hmm. And she said that she was upset that that her English teacher made them watch a blackface Shakespeare thing. And I asked what she was talking about and found out that she was talking about Laurence Olivier in Othello. And I was saying, well, that's not exactly blackface, because blackface is a very specific kind of minstrelsy performance and blah, blah, blah. She goes, it's still a white man with black makeup on. I guess if people are offended by it, then you have to take that seriously. But at the same time, should Olivier not have essayed that particular role, or should he have done it without darkening his skin? What do you think?
I think my answer to all of those sorts of difficult questions is you have to bring these things out into the light as they existed at the time and look at them and say, yes, I accept this, or no, I don't accept this, and here are the reasons why. But we can't pretend these things did not exist. And I saw a fantastic interview with Margot Jefferson, the African-American Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And Margot was talking about the whole issue of blackface, which, of course, we all find offensive. But her statement was, get these ideas out into the sunlight, because if they are bad ideas, they're going to wither and die away. We can't pretend they didn't exist or it be. And I think she said this, or if not, it's my interpretation. Otherwise, it becomes whack-a-mole and you try to, pretend it's not there and it pops up in another place. So I think. That's really how I agree with her on all the issues like that. I'm half Italian, and when I see some of the caricatures of Italian Americans in old movies, I'm like, are you kidding me with this stuff? But I can't pretend it didn't exist, and how the sea change that started with The Godfather came about.
Well, yeah, I mean, The Godfather is a good example, isn't it? I mean, the Godfather, played by Marlon Brando, who also played I did a movie in Yellowface, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that that's offensive to have a non-Italian playing that role?
I do not think it's offensive because, first of all, he's a fantastic actor. Mm-hmm. He made the film work so well. And although it was about mobsters, the reason why I said it was a sea change in the depiction of Italian Americans is there is not one stereotypical accent in sight. These are no longer organ grinders with the monkey on them. This is a full-fledged human being. And so if that's brought out into the light, that's okay by me.
What about Chico Marx? Does he offend you?
Well, I mean, the Marx brothers exist in their own universe.
Yes.
I can't even talk in a critical fashion about them. You just look at them, you shake your head, and you laugh. So, wow, we've gone from Audrey Hepburn to the Marx brothers and the Godfather.
Well, you're talking to me, Tom. We're talking to Tom Santapietro, and his new book, surprisingly from this conversation, is about Audrey Hepburn, and it's called Audrey Hepburn, A Life of Beautiful Uncertainty, and it's a really good book. Talk a little bit about the early years in the life of Audrey Hepburn, because they are astounding.
They are almost as if they're out of a Hollywood movie. As a little girl, she was born in 1929, and the two events that shaped her were the disappearance of her father when she was six, and then when she was 10, living in the Netherlands with her mother. There's an extraordinary scene where her mother walks in one morning, Audrey's asleep in bed, and her mother says, "Get up, the war's on." And the Germans had invaded the Netherlands, and the conditions were so horrible that by the end of the war, when Audrey was 16 in 1945, she had been reduced to eating nothing but tulip bulbs. There was literally no food. She was 5'7" and a half and weighed 90 pounds. And she said that if the war had lasted 2 to 4 more weeks, she would have died of starvation. And at the same time, she was working for the underground and carrying the underground newspaper, which was small and folded into sections. She would carry copies in her socks as she was walking or riding her bicycle. And she would carry messages to the downed flyers hiding out in the countryside. The courage, and yet she typically downplayed it completely and just would, when people asked her, would only say, "Oh, others did so much more than I did."
It's amazing, right? You know, and you said that at one point in her, and this is really hard to believe from anybody that's ever looked at her, that she was fat.
She had one moment in her life. I know it's very hard to believe. And it's when she, because when the war ended, you know, she was starving to death. So any food, she would just inhale it. And when it came, and that continued for a while. And when she was cast for Gigi on Broadway, and, you know, she came across on the line on the, I don't know if it was the Queen Mary or which boat it was, but, you know, there was food around the clock and she was eating nonstop. And she got off the boat and the producer said, "Well, who's this person who weighs 20 pounds more than the actress we cast?" And they literally put her on a diet. And of course, she lost the weight and never regained it ever again. But it's a sort of humorous image. And she had a great sense of humor. And she said, "Really, I was inhaling pots of jam." That was her phrase.
Well, do you think that she had to diet her whole life, or was she just slim?
She was just slim. I mean, there was one writer who claimed that Audrey was anorexic, and that is absolutely not true. I wanted to be really clear on that. She was just incredibly slim. She was disciplined about what she ate. But, you know, Audrey ate steak and she ate pasta, and Sean talked about that. So, it's just the way she was built.
She had a good metabolism, I guess.
Yes.
Are there any other films that she made before Roman Holiday, the film that everybody knows as her first film? But she made quite a few before.
Are, she,
Are there any that worth watching of those early ones?
Not really. So many of those early appearances were one line here, one line there, you know, nothing that really strikes you as, oh, I want to sit down and watch this. But she has, even in these small roles, you just notice her on screen. It's not just because we know she's Audrey Hepburn. She has those eyes and, you know, a star as opposed to very talented actor. A star is somebody the camera loves and they're the only person we want to watch. And that's really what happens with the early films. But, you know, she was getting training and the fact that she made this dog of a movie called, the title tells you everything, Monte Carlo Baby. It's a terrible movie. Nobody should watch it. But she said, oh, yeah, I'll do that because I'll go to Monte Carlo. I'll get to keep the dress at the end of the movie. And she was clowning around on the set one day. And that's where the novelist Colette saw her and said to her, I think you could be my Gigi on Broadway. And Audrey, in typical fashion, said, well, that sounds like a crazy idea. I've never acted on a stage before. But she got the role and everything changed.
Yeah, she never went back to stage acting after she won her Tony Award.
Right. When she won for Undine in the mid-50s, she never went back. And the one personal story I have about that is back in the 80s, because I've been working on Broadway for a long time now.
Yeah.
Producer friend and I came up with the idea. We wanted to bring Audrey Hepburn back to the Broadway stage after, you know, so many decades away. And so we wrote her a letter and we got the letter to her through a UNICEF connection. We knew she would get it. And Gary, pretty quickly, we got a letter back that was so extraordinary. First of all, it was on the most beautiful stationery imaginable, this pale blue with this small embossed, you know, name on it with beautiful upright handwriting. And the letter said the following. I am so honored that you would think of me and want to bring me back to Broadway. I appreciate your thinking of me, but my entire life is devoted to UNICEF and helping children, so I have to regretfully decline. Mm. And my friend and I looked at each other, and really, we said, if this is what rejection is, we are fine with being rejected, because it was just so beautiful. And of course, she would have been fantastic on stage again.
Well, when you got that letter in which she told you that UNICEF was her life, I guess that's true. I mean, how did she get involved with UNICEF?
She Audrey had a cousin who worked for UNICEF who had asked her a number of times if she would, you know, speak at a fundraiser. And finally, one year she said yes. It was a big fundraiser in Macau. And she was sensational. And people were so happy to hear from Audrey Hepburn. She raised a lot of money. So they asked again. It was even more successful. And they finally said to her, we'd like to make you a special ambassador. You know, you'll have a special passport. You will fly all around the world. And it was like the light bulb went on. She just thought this is what she wanted to do. And I say to everybody, this was not, you know, given a press conference in front of Tiffany's on Fifth Avenue. This was doing her homework, studying briefing papers, and flying to the most desolate parts of the world with flood ravaged children dying. And Henry Kissinger at one point had kind of rolled his eyes and said, oh, Bangladesh is a basket case. So Audrey Hepburn said, if he says that, that's where I want to go. And when her health started to fail, and I think it was partially related to the nonstop work for UNICEF, because she had to get so many inoculations over and over, and the stress of the travel. The last place, she wanted to go to Somalia, and there was no government left in Somalia, none at all, no infrastructure. And she said, no, I have to go. And she went there, and she was literally holding dying children in her arms. but she knew she could get attention and money raised to save children. And I, when I was researching the book, when she came back from Somalia, I found a film clip of her giving a press conference on French television, French, one of five languages she spoke fluently. And she, it was like you were seeing a different person. She could barely speak above a whisper because she was so almost broken by what she had seen. She said the silence of the children was overwhelming, but she would not give up. And ironically, that last trip, when her health completely failed, was a success because it brought so much attention to what was going on. And her son, Sean, said that on her deathbed, one of the last things she said was, "Any news from the children in Somalia?"
Wow. Well, you know, I remember hearing that Jerry Lewis was kind of living off the muscular dystrophy telethon, that he made a lot of money doing it and raising money, but he also raised money for himself. Did Audrey Hepburn, was she compensated by UNICEF for her work?
It was literally $1 a year. This was from the heart. They would pay the travel expenses. That was it, nothing else. And her companion, Robert Walters, was heavily involved with her. He would make the arrangements. But this was her life's work. She called it the role of a lifetime. And one thing that really struck me about it, and what, you know, I was so interested that she walked away from the Hollywood fame and found her purpose with UNICEF. And what really struck me was, it turned out, which I didn't know, Audrey Hepburn was good friends with Elizabeth Taylor. Mm. Now, we're talking stars who are so opposite, right? Elizabeth lived her life in the headlines, and Audrey was in a little village in Switzerland. But they really liked each other. And it struck me that at the near the end of their lives, they both used the same phrase completely independently of each other. And that phrase was, "At last, my fame makes sense to me." Elizabeth with her AIDS activism, and Audrey on behalf of UNICEF. And I think both women who had achieved, you know, all the fame, money, glamour in the world, they both arrived at the point where they felt none of that really matters. What matters is, how do we make a difference?
Well, that really is moving. I mean, when you think of, say, Greta Garbo, who also walked away from Hollywood in 1941 and lived another 50 years or more, she didn't do anything. She's
no. She just didn't. She didn't at all. And that's one of the reasons why I admired Audrey so much. And I draw the parallel to, it's the same thing with Doris Day. Mm-hmm. Doris Day walked away from Hollywood on her own terms, spent the last 45 years of her life on behalf of animal welfare.
She wouldn't even talk about her films, right?
Right. She really changed consciousness of it. And so Audrey was so fulfilled working for UNICEF. And that was a part. We're such a fame-obsessed country and society today. Everybody demands to be famous. And here's Audrey, world famous. And she said, "Oh, other things matter a lot more to me." And that was interesting to look at psychologically.
Well, Tom Sanchez-Pietro, let's talk a little bit about Broadway. So has Broadway come back? Has it bounced back from the pandemic?
I think it mostly has, Gary. I think I would say to you it's 90% back. It's more expensive than ever. It's very much, if it's a straight play, it is completely star-driven. That's how straight plays as opposed to musicals succeed. And every theater on Broadway is booked as we speak. So that's a pretty healthy sign.
And are you stage managing right now?
I am right now. I'm not stage managing. I'm working as what's called a house manager, managing the theater itself. Mm. And I float amongst a lot of different shows, which is great because I am at kind of every theater on Broadway. But it because it's freelance, it gives me time for my writing, which is really my priority. So
if someone is going to New York, what should they see right now?
Oh. That's a great question. It depends. If they want to see Big Star, then you go see George Clooney in Good Night, Good Luck.
Is it a good show?
I'm sorry?
Is it a good show? Have you seen it?
It is. I have not sat through it, although I want to. My spies tell me that the great thing about it is it's this really interesting story about Ed Murrow, and you're seeing George Clooney in person.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the selling point. Yeah. There's a new musical that people are really enjoying a lot, kind of a sleeper, called Buena Vista Social Club.
Yeah, based on the album.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of stuff that's about to open, a musical about Betty Boop, and Glengarry Glenn Ross just had a big revival with lots of big stars. So that opened last night.
Oh, wow. Who are the stars in that? Not Jack Lemmon. He's gone.
Jack Lemmon is no longer with us, but Kieran Culkin and Michael McKean and Bob, I never know how to say his last name, Ander from Better Call Saul.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know how to say it either, but yes,
yeah.
Bad guy.
listeners know who I'm talking about. Yeah. So, Broadway has mostly bounced back.
Well, that's good to know. Well, I love the new book. It's really great. And as I said, I think it's the book that you've invested yourself in the most. And it's called Audrey Hepburn, A Life of Beautiful Uncertainty. And it's a beautiful book as well as a beautifully written book. So thank you for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me on. This has been great.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.